Today on Movie Rollers, we talk about Unsane, Isle of Dogs, and Ready Player One. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theaters, on DVD, online streaming, or on the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you.
Oh, I like how you mixed that up.
I was going downhill with the taper. I know. I had to kind of put more energy into the end of it, so apologies for the exclaim. So, Two very highly anticipated movies to talk about today. I know, Rashmi, you're the world's biggest Wes Anderson fan.
That I am.
Ready Player One is a book that we've spoken about.
We all loved.
But we've spoken about it many times on the podcast, our anticipation with this movie. And then there's the Steven Soderbergh Unsane. So, yeah, kind of an interesting mix of movies to all come together. And that's a funny thing with this time of year, right? Everything's kind of
higgledy-piggledy,
starting to come out. So
to boil up, yeah, good.
So we're going to skip our Netflix pick for this week again. We're doing catch-up podcasting, so you get three movie reviews and no Netflix picks. But we'll get back on the Netflix train in a podcast or two, hopefully. So let's just get right into things. Where would you like to start? Unsane, Isle of Dogs, or Ready Player One?
So I'll introduce Unsane. Okay. So I'm endlessly fascinated by what Steven Soderbergh is doing. He famously, his last movie, Logan Lucky, he chose to kind of distribute it himself, and he kind of might have paid the price for that. He's really kind of playing with what's the best format for distributing movies and kind of getting out of the monopoly and, you know, kind of the evil system that exists with the studio system with distributing movies. And he's kind of playing constantly with that. Here is a movie that he's made, and its claim to fame is that the entire movie was shot on an iPhone. Although, you know, we all saw a movie last year.
Tangerine,
which was also shot on an iPhone. But be that as it may, Soderbergh kind of, this is one of his smaller films, ones which he seems to have slipped into the cinemas without much warning. And it's directed by him, and the writer credits are Jonathan Bernstein and James Greer. And this is a movie about a woman who appears to be, against her wishes, locked down in a mental institution. And she is confronted in the mental institution by her greatest fear. But the whole, you know, the whole undertow of the movie is how much of this is real and how much of it is self-imagined. So I presume this is one of those, you know, classic unreliable narrator stories. And the cast here includes Claire Foy from television's The Crown. It also includes Amy Irving, that Amy Irving from a long time ago. It also includes Jay Farrow and Juno Temple, who we know. So you guys both saw this film. And what does it add to Soderbergh's
repertoire?
Yes.
Well, first thing, I've got to deal with the iPhone thing, because why, when you have a movie that has apparently a decent, you know, cast, these people weren't cheap, these sets and story weren't cheap, do you kind of make this odd decision to film the movie exclusively on, you know, a handheld cell phone? I feel like that was gimmickry.
Too gimmicky, yeah.
And, you know, Sean Baker, when he did Tangerine, did it because he had no money, like zero, zilch. But this movie has a budget, so I can't think of any other reason for shooting on iPhones than to get some buzz about the movie. And maybe there's, you know, maybe I need to research this a little bit, but it just felt like a really annoying thing, because It shows that this movie was cheaply shot. It's blurry. It's not very, you know, the visuals aren't crisp in the way that we want visuals to be these days. So I don't know. It just felt like it was a disservice. With that said, I really enjoyed this little movie. Soderbergh is hit or miss for me. You know, probably more hit than miss. But you know, I've been a big fan of his, you know, his funny little movies, like, you know, the one where he hired the UFC fighter. What was that one called?
With Gina
the one that you
Carano.
Both loved.
Yeah,
with Gina Carano.
Havoc or something Havoc, like that. Yeah. So
no. That movie comes up a lot in our podcasts.
I really liked it. Yeah. Sorry, I can't recall the name of it right now, but this felt
Haywire.
Thank you. This movie felt, you know, along the same veins. It's compact. It's very, very punchy. It gets right into things. I mean, we have, you know, a 2-minute kind of preamble, and then boom, this movie goes to tell its story. And it has a couple of different stories to tell. You know, one is, you know, about the evils of industry, and then the other is about the questionable sanity of the main protagonist. It's not particularly original, but it worked really well for me. I had a lot of fun with this movie.
I have to say, so Joe, your preamble about the iPhone, I didn't even realize that it was shot on an iPhone. And actually, with my bad eyesight and my refusal to wear glasses,
it looked fine.
It looked fine, right? So, and the only thing I did notice was a lot of the film at the beginning was in close-up, but now I understand why. But the thing that makes me laugh is that just people running around the set with their iPhones? Is it like one iPhone, or does everyone have an iPhone? Anyway, that's probably for another podcast. That being said,
I think everyone has an iPhone.
Right. I really like Claire Foy on The Crown. So I was excited to see how she'd do in a non-tiara wearing British accent movie. And I think she did a really good job, considering she carries most of the movie with a little bit of help, I think, from Juno Temple. I like that it's a very efficient movie. It gets in, it does its thing, and then it gets out. Exactly what Joe said. I think what it accomplishes in that time is good and thrilling and more than adequate. I wouldn't rush out and see this one at the cinema. That's not to say it's a bad movie. It's just not one of those that I would rush out to see when there's all of this really good stuff on at the moment. I enjoy the ride while it lasted, but I think it will quickly lose mindshare for me. In fact, probably by the time this podcast is over, I probably won't even remember that I saw this.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the opposite of an instant classic.
Yeah.
It's a great movie in the moment.
Yeah.
But we won't be talking about this next week.
Yeah.
You know, it's come and gone.
Completely.
But that doesn't mean to say that while it was here, it was anything other than fabulously entertaining.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, I think maybe he didn't have any more ambition than that. He probably wants to show that you can make a very cheap movie. You can get reasonable actors. You can shoot it on an iPhone. You can release it and make some money and then move on to your next film.
I think it's
it's a different scale than, like, I mean, like Lucky Logan is still playing in my head. It plays every day in my head. I love that film. This is not, I don't think it's even trying to be
Lucky. And that's,
you know, in scope even. Yeah.
Exactly. You took the words right off of my page.
Oh,
I mean, you know, no. It's absolutely true. This isn't his best work, I think. It's not as glitzy and as polished or as smart as Logan Lucky. But you know what? It's fine. It's perfectly fine. And it feels to me like it builds on that movie that he did a few years ago called Side Effects. Remember the one with Rooney Mara and Channing Tatum, where she takes a new drug and she has side effects.
That was Soderbergh.
And
that's
the one
right.
thing he does is he shows mania and that going mad process, the going crazy process. I think he captures it very well in this movie.
Yeah.
My only criticism, and Joe, you alluded to this at the beginning, is that it's trying to use this platform of thriller horror to make a political statement about healthcare, which kind of got lost through the movie, and then it kind of appears, and then it disappears, and then it appears, and it disappears. That's my only criticism of the movie, if I had one. It's tight. It's well filmed. It works.
Yeah. It speaks to Soderbergh's talent as a storyteller, and I think he doesn't mess around. There's no fat in this movie. It moves from scene to scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
Everything advances. There's no point where you're kind of, where are we in this story, or what's going on here? Or it's very linear, you know. It's also you know, kind of thrilling as you're going along with it. So again, you're right, Yasti. I think, you know, that rationale for using, you know, less expensive tools may be more of what he's trying to say here than anything else, because he's mucking around with he very famously quit Hollywood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Three films ago,
right? Yeah. And he can't help himself. I think this stuff just brews within him. It kind of spills out, and he probably can't sleep unless he's making movies. But, you know.
But at least he's trying something different.
He probably is doing all of these different ways of trying to get movies out and distributed. Because remember, very famously, he quit because of the Liberace movie.
Yes. Where,
despite the fact that the movie was
behind the chandelier, well, that one.
Behind the candelabra.
Candelabra, yeah. Candelabra, chandelier.
Which was made with great cast and fanfare. But, you know, his reason for quitting Hollywood over that movie was because nobody was willing to take the distribution.
So why don't we call it a tantrum versus a quit? Can we agree to call that Steven Soderbergh's tantrum that he had?
Well, I don't think he's gone back to making movies the old way just yet, but...
Yeah.
Listen, all is forgiven. I think he's an essential American filmmaker. So
I agree.
Whatever he
I
does,
agree.
We are just do absolutely, yeah. absolutely yeah. without a question, better off with him making movies than
yeah.
that. So.
Yeah.
I'll wrap up. Compact, punchy... Very, very entertaining and entirely disposable. So I'm going to give it a 8 out of 10.
Really?
Yeah, really liked it. Really, really liked it.
Solid Soderbergh film, this is. Again, like you said, Joe, he's a bit hit or miss for me. Usually more miss than hit. Solid 7. Solid 7 from Soderbergh.
Yeah, I won't necessarily say rush out and see this, but when it hits Netflix... Watch the hell out of this.
Yeah, I agree.
Everybody, okay. Please.
Yeah.
Okay.
You wouldn't be insane.
Yeah.
For watching Unsane. Say,
yeah, why Unsane? It's kind of annoying.
No, it's clever. It's clever when you watch the movie.
Okay. And then I must go on record to say I really loathe the posters for this movie. They're kind of this hallucinogenic two images laid on top of each other. I think it just makes it look cheesy and
makes
cheap.
It look very 80s, I think.
Yeah, and maybe that's in line with the movie. I don't know.
But. I was gonna say it almost exactly reflects the experience of watching the movie. Maybe not your thing, Yazdi, but that's okay. Kind of like, whoa.
But watching what doesn't make me want to watch world. That movie. When I see that poster, I'm like, this seems stupid. But anyway,
it's entirely
I'm too
relevant.
Judgmental. Yes. Speaking of judgmental.
Yes. Let's move on.
Isle of Dogs or Ready Player One?
I Love Dogs.
Okay.
Okay, so in this stop motion animated film from my lovely, admired director, writer, filmmaker, creative man, Wes Anderson, an outbreak of canine flu in Japan leads all dogs to be quarantined on an island. So a boy, who is the voice of Koyu Rankin, journeys there to rescue his dogs. His dog Spot, who's played by Liev Schreiber, and gets help from a pack of misfit canines who have also been exiled. His quest inspires a group of dog lovers to expose a government conspiracy. The voice cast also includes Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Scarlett Johansson, Tilda Swinton, Bob Balaban, Greta Gerwig, and Yoko Ono, amongst a whole host of
Yoko
others.
Yoko Ono, isn't it?
Yes. So this is directed by Wes Anderson, and writing credits go to Wes Anderson, Roman Coppola, it's the same team again, Jason Schwartzman, Kunichi Nomura, and screenplay by Wes Anderson.
Okay.
So Yazdi, I know you love dogs.
God, do I love dogs, yes.
And this is I Love Dogs.
This is a full aisle full of dogs.
And is that a pun, by the way?
Yes.
I Love Dogs, I Love Dogs.
Oh, is it?
It is.
I never got it until this very moment. Is it? I Love Dogs. Oh, I love dogs.
I know you do.
it's lovely. I liked everything about the movie. I think...
And sorry, Yazdi, yes. On the Wes Anderson scale, where do you sit in terms of your love and adoration
of him? I think, and this is the comment I was going to make, I think Wes Anderson really gets carried away. He's like such a prisoner of his own fetishes and his own, you know, ridiculous need for things to be so perfect and just so, and, you know, shots being perfectly symmetrical and whatever, that I think he sometimes goes overboard. And particularly in reference to this movie, I think he gets a little carried away. But there is nobody else like him. There's nobody else like him in the US. There's nobody else like him, you know, outside the world. So I think he's there's such a unique sensibility about his films that when you're watching it, you just need to watch like 5 minutes of it and you're like, this is a Wes Anderson movie. And there's not, you can't say that about it to a lot of filmmakers. So I'm completely always, you know, team Anderson. I love this movie. You know, this movie could have kind of keeled over by being too precious and, you know, about the dogs being too cutesy, and the dogs are never, ever cute. They're almost distant, and they're kind of their own personalities, and they're gruff, and they are their own individual characters. But, you know, I liked how the movie is so academically constructed. The whole movie feels like a giant algorithm, like somebody has created, and it just follows these charts from, you know, if not A, go to B. There's something very mechanical about the movie, but there's a lot of, you know, Anderson's movies are always mechanical. But be that as it may, there's this British filmmaker called Peter Greenaway, and he's made, you know, lots of movies, famously The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and His Lover. But and he, by the way, also has a tremendous fetish for Japanese culture. But he has made movies which are impossible to watch at one sitting, because he will have the screen split up into five pieces, and there'll be a Japanese script running there and somebody else running there. It's kind of, he overloads you, you know, with information. And he almost starts doing this now in The Isle of Dogs, where the screen splits into two or three and there's different things going on. So he's kind of almost overindulging himself, I think, and he needs to pull back a little bit. But that's all nonsense. I love the movie. I loved how hard scrabble it is. There's nothing pink and cute and yellow and sunshiny about it. It's all dark and jagged and coal colored. And, you know, I loved it. I love the dogs. I love the people. I loved everything.
Joe.
So I'm not the biggest of Wes Anderson fans. I'll say that right off the bat. I mean, I think I liked Moonrise Kingdom a lot more than the rest of you, I think. I'm not the biggest fan of Budapest Hotel. It was far too precious, and I know this is sacrilege to Rashmi. So I feel like, you know how like when we reviewed a movie like Interstellar, where I'm the biggest Nolan fanboy, and you two turn into grumpy boots just because I'm such a fan? Well, I feel like I'm that guy here, because honestly,
the grumpy boots or the fanboy?
The grumpy boots.
Mm-hmm.
To counter the fanboy across the desk from me, which is Rashmi in particular. But, you know, look, yes, the overindulgence is exactly the way I felt about this movie. Right from the get-go, it's so fussy. Everything is, you know, I've done a little bit of photography in my time. The rule of thirds, the perfect symmetry, the placement of everything on screen, and this constant sense of, and we talked about this in the last podcast, where I found the death of Stalin a little grating, because it felt like the director and the writers and everyone involved with the project was going, look at how smart we are. Well, this is Wes Anderson going, look at all the Wes Andersonisms that I can put into one frame of film, and then extending that for like an hour and a half. I found it almost insufferable, and I didn't find myself pulled into the story. I didn't find myself caring about the characters. I found myself constantly distracted by the Wes Andersonisms of the movie, and I hate that, because I think at its heart is a story that I would love. I love dogs. I love animals, and I wanted to love these dogs, and I wanted to love this story, and I just found the whole thing distracting and weird. So I really, really struggled. This is my least favorite Wes Anderson movie to date. And I don't hate the man, but I really, really, really struggled with this. And I'm out there on my own island.
Your own Isle of Dogs.
With this particular Isle of Joe.
I can't believe realize it's Isle of Dogs. Anyway, carry on.
Okay. So, you know, as Joe says, you know, before we went to the movie and I was super excited because I pray at the temple of Wes Anderson. Yes. Joe was telling me, you know, how precious he thought Anderson can be. And I was telling him, you know, that I don't disagree, but for me, it's never distracting because it always serves the purpose of the story, and the story and the direction are so good that I can overlook the preciousness. Not this time. I didn't hate this movie, but I didn't love it because I, you know, normally I'm the one who loves everything by Wes Anderson. I'm disappointed. I'm really disappointed because there just wasn't enough story this time to walk the gimmick to the finish line. That's not to say that there aren't moments of cleverness and comedy. It just seemed too light on content and bursting with this Japanese style and sensibility instead. And when I compare that to someone like Tarantino, who did Kill Bill, who's equally obsessed with Japanese culture, he manages to do a story that's chock full of story. That just didn't happen here. And I also found the cadence both in the speech and the story itself way too precious. I just couldn't get over it. I almost found it as insufferable as Joe. And I kept waiting for it to get really good. Like, I kept thinking, where's the twist that's going to bring me back to where has this gone wrong? And where is it going to correct itself? So I'll be like, all is right again.
You know, I mean, I think it suffers from style over substance. You can see the diagrams very obviously. You can see the nuts and bolts, and you can see there isn't much flesh to hang on the bones.
Right.
But be that as it may, I mean, I think it's a labor of love. So I didn't realize I'd be the one defending the movie.
I know.
I think it's clearly a labor of love, and you know, I would rather somebody burn up, you know, like a candle then kind of just dimly, you know, light a corner of the room and he burns. I mean, he always goes, he goes all the way.
Yeah, he balls to the wall, right?
I mean, I compare this with something like, you know, his only other stop motion movie, which was the wonderful Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Which was fantastic.
Which is probably, again, among the movies that I like of his.
Right.
You know, it's up there.
Yeah, but I kind of liked that each of these dogs has a particular character, and they kind of talk. I know they have a weird cadence. It almost feels like a line reading,
right?
Like they're all sitting on a table.
It's like they all kind of talk like this,
right?
And so this is a dog, and this is something very exciting happening. And it's like, come on.
Yeah, and we cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, even, you know, that's, again, I do want to stress that there are moments which are genius and there are moments which are incredibly funny. And they physically made me laugh. And I like that this is a story about the lengths that a little boy will go to because he loves his dog and he wants to rescue him. I mean, what's not to love about that? But it's all too strange. And you can accept things being strange and fantastical and dogs talking if you accept that universe. But the universe didn't have enough to hang on to.
The Japanese thing felt very gimmicky to me.
It felt very forced. So the whole thing felt very whimsical and forced for me.
Almost offensive to me.
So that's the thing. There's been a lot. I think nobody has attacked this movie as much for its content or how good it is as much as for the perceived cultural appropriation. Like, you know, it seems like he's just taken this Japanese culture and kind of played with it to his own degree of hipsterism. I mean, even the first credit of the movie is this, all the credits are in Japanese and it has this black with a red, you know, mm-hmm. very Japanese thing. And I knew about that before I watched the movie, and I didn't personally find it offensive. Although if you read a lot of reviews, many people are turned off by that, really strongly turned off by that. I just saw it as him being kind of clearly in love with Japanese culture, and, you know, he's in love with that whole World War II kind of where Japan was and that.
The taiko drummer type thing.
Correct.
Which is lovely. The taiko drummers are great. I was so excited when that started the movie off. That beat and that sound was so energetic. It's the most energetic thing about the movie, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I don't personally find that he has kind of crossed the line or been offensive or that he has necessarily taken somebody else's culture and kind of, you know, demeaned it or made it beneath, you know, its rightful place or any of that. I mean, I just think he should make, you know, he's become a victim of his own tics and eccentricities at this point, and I think he really needs to bring it in check. And I want him to do a simple, you know, movie which doesn't have Bill Murray and, you know,
Edward Norton, Tilda Swinton.
And we're not going to get that because the rest of the world of critics has.
I'm not even against that. I mean, you know, again, you know, we see a lot of directors have their muses, which is fine. I think Joe, you made an interesting point, or one of you just said. I think he's trying to be too hipster, to the point where I don't think he's bastardized the Japanese culture. I don't feel like it's offensive in that way. But it's the use of a character like Tracy Walker, which is played very well by Greta Gerwig. But she's a little American girl with a blonde afro. And not just an afro, but a huge afro that fills the screen. And so I think it's a strange choice. And it doesn't add to the story.
Right.
But it's a very deliberate choice to have
it's weird
a little
for the sake
American
of being weird.
Schoolgirl with a big blonde afro.
It's weird for the sake of being weird. Right. As opposed to this admonishes some characteristic on the character.
Yeah, or moves the story forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else on this one? I'll go cry in a corner. Yazdi, why don't you start us off? No, let's do that. Let's start with Joe. We'll do a Yazdi sandwich.
So,
I'm showing you fingers. Is it 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, 4 out of 10?
I'm going to have to give this a Wes Anderson style 3 out of 10.
Oh.
Because it's rule of thirds everywhere, and it got a third of the points for me. I mean, it's just that's the kind of way he would score a movie too. I mean, yeah, it was dull. And Wes Anderson, among many things,
he's not dull.
He's never been dull for me. I've not been in tune with his style, but I've never been bored. I was bored. I hate to feel boredom in a movie theater, particularly with a Wes Anderson movie, but I was bored. 3. Ouch.
Yazdi.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, when I go to see a Tarantino film, as much as Tarantinoisms have started to grate on me, I kind of take it for the, you know, I still complain. So it's likewise, you go to see an Anderson movie, you know, you kind of sign up for that. But like I said, this one was, even by his own standards, a little too obvious with all the diagrams and arrows going one way and, you know, split screens and whatnot. And he just needs to slow down and chill out and, you know, have a glass of wine, Wes Anderson. Have a wine spritzer or two. But I still loved it because it ultimately about a kid who's trying to find his dog. And, you know, there's some a little bit of clever bit about the name of the dog and, you know, how he's mixed up with someone else. 7 out of 10.
Too whimsical without heft and emotion for a movie that's about man's best friend. Not a complete pile of dog poop, but a failure for me. Although I still love dogs, this didn't make me want to wag my tail. 5 out of 10.
Oh.
Never thought I would be giving a Wes Anderson movie an average score.
That's too bad.
I think it's my combination of Anderson and dogs, which was hard for me to resist. But
no, the ingredients
it has its
are there.
Charms, yeah.
Yeah, the ingredients are there. Yeah. Just okay.
Another next
Let's
one,
move
which
on
is
to
highly anticipated.
Movie number 3, which is Ready Player One, and I'll give this one a very brief intro. So, a couple of years ago, I kept hearing about this book, Ready Player One, Ready Player One, Ready Player One. I finally picked up a copy of it and devoured it in seemingly minutes. I then told Rashmi about it, who devoured it in an equally short space of time. And yes, dear, no, we've spoken about it. You also read the book.
I loved it, yes.
The book's written by Ernest Cline, who also co-wrote the screenplay for Ready Player One. And the basic setting of the movie is it's the year 2045. Everyone essentially lives in virtual reality. The setup of the virtual reality that has taken over the world is a system called the Oasis, and it's something that you can essentially live your whole life in if you choose to, apart from, you know, biological functions, bathroom breaks, that kind of thing, and people do. The creator of the Oasis has died, and he has, in very Charlie in the Chocolate Factory style, left the keys to the Oasis to whoever can find three of the keys that he has hidden without it. The years have gone by and nobody's been able to find these keys, and enter our protagonist, Wade Watts, who has been on a quest and starts to make some progress. So this movie is directed by Steven Spielberg. It's written by Zach Penn and Ernest Cline in terms of the screenplay. It stars Tyce Sheridan, Olivia Cook, Ben Mendelsohn, Simon Pegg as the kind of the major leads, and Mark Rylance, of course, as the recently deceased owner of the Oasis. So I have been nervously anticipating this movie. I must admit the trailers weren't quite what I was hoping for. I think the aesthetic of the Oasis, as depicted in the trailers, were somewhat different to the way that I had imagined them to be in the book. But the book is full of pop culture references, and in some ways Steven Spielberg is, you know, himself a pop icon of the 80s, the right director for this. So I watched this with some excitement. Guys, what did you think of Ready Player One?
So like you, Joe, I've been waiting for this movie with bated breath, and since we saw the movie, I've been waiting for this review with bated breath, because Joe and I saw this as civilians. I think we missed the screening, and Joe and I came out of the show, and we said, "Are we reviewing this one?" And we said, we kind of looked at each other and we went, "No." And then we went, "Okay," expecting that each other was going to tell us what we thought, and then we didn't say anything because we knew we wanted to talk about this movie. And we knew we wanted to talk about it with you, Yazdi, because we've all been waiting for the movie. So I'm just so happy that this wasn't bad. In fact, I'm really happy that it was actually good. And I like that it's different from the book, that it takes a divergence from the book. I think they did it really well. I really, really, really like this movie. Well done, Steven Spielberg.
Yazdi.
Yeah, I mean, when I read Ready Player One, somebody at work had recommended it to me. And I read it very quickly. And I thought if there's ever a book which is unfilmable, it would be Ready Player One, because, you know, it's really difficult with the content, because so much of it occurs in this virtual reality space, the Oasis, and, you know, substantially less happens in the real world. And if anybody could be up to doing that, it would be Steven Spielberg. And, you know, I've kind of commended Steven Spielberg for taking a kind of a strange turn in his career, where he's kind of pursued these historical movies which have a very strong political conscience. I mean, he's done
The Post most recently.
He did The Post, and before that he did Bridge of Spies, and then before that he did
Lincoln.
And so, yeah, so it's interesting to see him kind of get back to his pulpy, not pulpy, but essentially, you know, middle of the road, just entertainment like nobody else does. And I think by those means, the movie kind of felt just a little undercooked for me. It seemed like it could have polished off a few pieces here and there. Now the book is bulky. It's a thin book, but the book has a lot of plot. And so it seems like there's a lot crammed into the movie. I kind of sense that the movie wasn't really taking a breath to sit and let anything sink in. It just goes from one thing to the other. And I mean, I've never been a gamer. I kind of always was watching it from an outsider's perspective as well. So I don't think by any means this is one of Spielberg's best movies. It feels like it should have gone through one more rewrite or something like that. But as just pop culture, popcorn entertainment, it's successful.
Joe.
I'm like you, Esty. I didn't think that this movie would translate to film very well at all. I mean, the book would translate to film.
I remember being shocked. We were shocked when it was being made into a film.
And as I alluded to earlier, I think the choice of Spielberg was kind of interesting to me because I thought if anyone can do this, then he's probably the right director for it. But the trailers just felt like The Oasis was dark and full of these kind of weird CG creatures. The Oasis that we get in the movie actually is very akin to the Oasis that we saw in the book. And that was a lovely surprise to me because I felt that in many ways this movie is an animation, right? We have huge CG content. The virtual reality world of the Oasis is depicted in CG, and I felt disappointed in many ways that I didn't see the movie in 3D because I think it would have really, really benefited from that from a visual storytelling perspective. But overall, I think the choices that they made divert away from the story in the book were wise because I think that the book talks about a game called Joust, which is anyone who grew up in the 70s or 80s and spent any time in those penny arcades spending quarters on games knows what Joust is. But it's kind of an obscure reference. Indeed, the finale of the movie is kind of an obscure video game reference, which they kept. But for good reasons, it had a bit more accessibility in terms of the plot. But they made some different choices. They made some different choices about which characters to emphasize. But this movie whipped along at a frenetic pace, and it was so much fun. And the finale itself came together brilliantly. You know, I did find myself somewhat kind of emotional towards the end of it, which was very surprising given the fact that this is an action movie at its heart, right? So I really, really enjoyed this movie and would recommend it to anybody. I think it has more fun if you recognize lots and lots of the little in-jokes and Easter eggs and pop culture references. But as a fun time at the movies, this was wonderful. It's everything I hoped it could be as a movie.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that last point you made, Joe. I think it's the thing that's most pleasurable for those of us that grew up in the 80s and recognize that pop culture, all those pop culture references. And then it's also, I think it's bane if you didn't, because if you don't understand those pop culture references, and there are so many of them, I mean, it's endless, right? From the Breakfast Club to Terminator to hundreds and hundreds of pieces of music clips and things that people are wearing and saying and bits of dialogue that pop in. If you don't get that, then I can see, Yazdi, that you are watching it like an outsider. Mm-hmm. but I think overall, you know, the fact that I was part of that pop culture growing up and I did understand it, had a permanent smile on my face because I kept seeing things or recognizing things or bits from other movies that were made reference to. I just feel like it could have gone wrong in so many ways and it didn't. I love that it captured more of the relationship that these gamers have with each other that end up working together. I think there are some great messages about capitalism and being true to yourself and poverty and life and love and the universe and everything just felt very tight. I was actually disappointed when the movie ended. I really loved this movie.
Yeah, I felt like I was playing a game of catch up. Like there were all these, I mean, it's so cluttered, right? The Oasis is so cluttered. I mean, you almost need to freeze frame the whole movie and watch everything that's on there. There's like 100 things on each frame. And I felt like, okay, that reference missed me. That reference missed me. And there were certain references which I did get. There was, you know, the Shining. There's a whole
scene
which is under the Shining.
Yes.
Batman references. There's, you know, all kinds of stuff. So it kind of became like I was trying, like I was in a race and I was trying to, you know, reach this object, which was always a little bit out of my reach. I will give you this much though. I mean, One of our great actors who's remained hidden now for the last 3-4 years. He's done amazing work on a lot of shows on Netflix, and he's been in a lot of movies, is Ben Mendelsohn, and he plays the bad guy here. And he is incredible. He's really, really good. And I think if for nothing else, I think this movie will be the one where everybody will recognize him.
Yeah.
You know, he's done a tremendous job.
Yeah.
So I really like that. Tyler Sheridan, who we've seen in a few other movies, do a remarkable job. Doesn't get much to do because so much of the movie is about him in his avatar in the Oasis. But and you know, to give credit where it's due, some of those action pieces in the Oasis are just beautifully rendered, just incredible.
But even that merging of the CG world when they're wearing when they are their avatars, and then their real film that plays when they're in the they're like in this library where they go and find, you know, where the
Halliday's memories.
Yeah, Halliday's memories are all stored. That merging of real film and CGI is flawless. And for the fact that we're watching a CGI movie, it never feels like we're watching a CGI movie. Maybe that's because we're expecting to see a CGI movie. It's a bizarre mindfuck. It's beautiful to look at. And even the creation of the stacks, mm-hmm. It's really smart.
And the stacks, just, you know, for folks who haven't seen the movie, it's the visual rendering of the 2045 Ohio world.
Right, which is really trailers on top of one another that have grown up.
It's essentially trying to say that if everyone exists in virtual world, then homes and housing don't matter, right?
Right.
If you get to put this mask on and live anywhere you want to be,
right?
Why does it matter if you have, you know, suburbs and so on and so forth?
Yeah. Anything else on this one, or should we wrap it up?
I mean, maybe it's a criticism of the book more than the movie, but I do feel that, you know, you mentioned the stacks, Rashmi, so it kind of takes me there. I did feel that the world outside of the Oasis was a little underdeveloped. I mean, I think some of the family moments, you know, Wade is targeted outside of the Oasis at some point because of the value of the prize. I felt that was a little watered down. I think that the relationships that he had with his family outside of the Oasis and the world in which he kind of inhabited as a real person, as opposed to the virtual rendering of Wade, could have been explored a little more. But I think they made deliberate cuts to try and keep the movie pushing along at the frenetic pace at which it goes. So I get it, but I feel that that was maybe a little bit of a missed opportunity there.
Yeah, I agree with what Yazdi said. I think this is definitely going to need a second viewing to try and catch up with everything we may have missed because we were reminiscing about the things we were seeing.
Yeah. I mean, the book has this, but the movie also does a good job about its political commentary about, you know, if we let things be where we will be, you know, 40 years from now, and, you know, how virtual reality, which is now only now being presented to us as the shiny, gleaming thing, may actually be a soul, you know, corrupting, you know, thing if you let it. So I think there's some of that at the start of the movie.
Yeah,
I wish the movie had a little bit more edge and it was a little bit more subversive, but then it couldn't have been a big blockbuster movie. So I know that Spielberg had to walk that line to, at its heart, work for, and that's where the difficulty is. This movie needs to work for everyone. It needs to work for the absolute 80s Dungeons and Dragons, you know, fanatic, and it has to work with somebody who has no clue about anything related to VR or about video gaming. So he walks that line very well, but I just wished it had been more of one or the other, that it would have been kind of more like, you know, Total Recall, you know, how Total Recall kind of had a little bite to it and an edge to it, and it wasn't like what you had seen.
Right.
But be that as it may, I enjoyed it. I don't know if I want to see it again. It was very overwhelming when I watched it. Again, I'm the outsider here. 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, when I compare it to that movie, you know, from way back in like 2009, Surrogates, which was also about this virtual reality. And remember, it was the Bruce Willis film.
Movie, yeah.
You know, how far we've come in our conceptualization of an oasis or a virtual reality. This was amazing. This was a knockout. I am ready for round two. Mm. Oh, score. 9 out of 10.
Wow.
Yeah, I love this. I love this movie.
Fantastic. I'm amazed you managed to keep your mouth shut then, because you were really...
poker-faced. You're probably...
Yeah, I had no idea that you liked it that much.
Love this movie. Terrific. In fact, I actually want to go back and read the book, and then I want to watch the film again.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to gush quite as much as that, but there's no real reason that I'm not. This was, again, when you think about the challenge of translating this story to screen, I'm sure that's why they retained Ernest Cline on the writing team here, because I think the book was such a remarkable story. And it had lots of these little pop culture references in that were integral to the story, the fabric of the world, and the character of Halliday, mm-hmm. who, despite having, you know, died before the movie starts, is very much present throughout the movie. This was a huge challenge, and I'm really glad they took made the choices that they did. Even though a couple of them were a little disappointing, I think they made sense for the world and the universe. So, 8 out of 10 for me, and I really do want to watch it again. So, you know, I actually would pay the extra money to see it in 3D. This world was so well realized, and that was really the frightening thing for me going into this was, I've seen too many of these, you know, ogre type creatures that wander around, you know, CG, you know, it looked like World of Warcraft. If you remember that horrible movie from a year or two ago, it was looking like that from the trailers. And the fact that the Oasis that we got was so, so well aligned with the stuff that was in my mind speaks to how well and how lovingly this movie was crafted. Okay, so movies this week were Unsane, Isle of Dogs, and Ready Player One. So hope you enjoy the podcast. Let us know what you think of the movies.
There's a lot to watch.
There's a lot going on right now. Yes. Yeah, out there. So we probably have one more catch-up podcast to do, and then we'll be relatively current, and we'll try and stay on top of all the releases that are coming at us thick and fast for 2018 so far. So until our next podcast, Too Many Movies, Too Little Time, and goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.